Well, this is Daniel Carter, Sabir Mateen. Couple of excellent players, most recently based in New York, who are here to perform in trio with Andrew Barker, who's really Atlanta-based, more or less.
Yeah, he is right there.
Right there.
New York-based.
New York-based, but
New York-based.
Atlanta.
Well, from Atlanta. I've been in New York for 10 years.
Right. Well, shows what I know, huh?
But you got a Georgia spirit.
Georgia spirit.
Yes.
The dirty.
The Georgia spirit, the Georgia sound, it's your Georgia swing, and he does his thing.
You sure you don't want a mic? You might
not
be good,
unless
man.
You can't hear me.
No, but you could do your routine more, I think, with a mic. Especially if you want to sing.
I don't have a routine.
Okay, man.
Because, you see, when you have a routine, that means you'll be doing the same thing over and over again.
It's like stepping in the same river twice.
Right. You know, or it's like having...
Or imagining that you could step in the same river
twice. Right.
It won't be the same. It won't be the same. Be messed up.
No, that's true.
Go ahead.
You know, one of the things you guys are most famous for together is your subway gigs in, Manhattan.
Playing with tests.
Playing with tests.
See if the test.
But that one didn't start with, there were some, you played with...
Sabir was playing in the subway. You were playing in the street, right, Sabir?
Yeah.
And I was playing in the street before Test.
And Tom was playing in the street
And Tom was playing, Tom Bruno, the drummer of Test.
Right.
Yeah.
And then, unfortunately, Tom gave me a call.
Yeah.
Before we knew it, we had a new group.
Right.
Consolidating the street.
There was no playing in the subway prior to Test?
Well, I used to play with Tom before Test.
Right.
We played standards.
Really?
Yep. With Bob Arkin.
I was mostly playing on the street, and then an official came by with her card saying that you could audition to officially play in the subway.
Right.
Yeah.
That was the music under New York series.
Right.
How did that work? I mean, it was like you got licensed to...
I have the slightest idea. I never auditioned for it. I've been taught never to audition, and I broke the rule.
I know they
once.
Built a whole a bureaucracy on top of it, and everybody got paid guaranteed money except the musicians.
So the musicians, there was no money for the musicians to actually play.
I think for a moment there was some tokens.
Right, you used to get tokens.
Subway tokens?
Subway tokens.
So you could ride for play and you ride for
free?
And then
they cut that out.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Yeah. Our 9/11 hero buddy.
Rudy?
Cut that out. Yes. It was
9/11 hero buddy?
Well, that's what they say it is.
Rudy Giuliani, the hero of 9/11?
Yes. The hero of 9/11.
You don't buy that?
I don't buy anything but food, clothing, and records.
What's the last record you bought?
I bought one recently. It was really amazing, too. I put it on layaway.
Uh-huh.
But see, I'm trying to get my record collection back together where I used to have it. I sold over about 500 records back to this family that lived in L.A. They were moving, and I didn't want to move.
Right.
So I get to keep all my records. I don't need them. That was the dumbest thing I ever did, one of them. And so now I'm trying to buy all them all on CD.
Right.
So 2 weeks before Andrew Hill died, I bought Compulsion. Mm. Not even knowing that he was ready to split.
Right.
I bought Compulsion and put it in layaway. Mm. We used to play a song on there called Limbo.
Was that, when did you play that?
Oh, every time Horace Tapscott would leave.
Really?
Yeah. Well, because, you know, one of the guys, you know, used to like them, so we would play.
You know. He wouldn't let you play other pianists' works?
No, we'd play anybody. Nobody arranged it for the band.
Right.
You know, we just, you know, some things you do with the leader, some things you want to do with after the leader.
Right.
You know. I find that happens everywhere, you know. Mm-hmm.
When did you actually head out to L.A. and hook up with Tapsco?
Well...
Because you were from Philly, right?
Yeah. Everywhere I landed has weird circumstances. I landed in L.A. because I got stranded. Because as soon as I got out of the Air Force... Which doesn't know what the Air Force means.
Yeah.
It means United Snakes Air Force. Anyway.
United Snakes.
Yeah.
Air Force.
Yeah, you know. Okay. United States of Mind.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I used all my leave time. So they just gave me a thing and said, you got to survive where you can. So I got out and I was stranded in San Bernardino. So I stayed in San Bernardino. And then I moved with my friend's family in L.A., which is another weird thing. They were related to Charlie Christian.
Hmm.
The mother was Charlie Christian's first cousin.
Uh-huh.
That's how I got in L.A.
Right.
And I used to listen to... That's when I really got into Charlie Parker. I used to listen to Burber Strings for 5 or 6 hours every day. They used to get mad and say, you're going to destroy my unique 33 and a third recording. It was a unique recording. You know they don't have those.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, I used to listen to Charlie Parker and Ray Brown and Buddy, what's his name? You know, the drummer.
Buddy Rich?
Yeah. And boy, they used to play that. You know. Mm-hmm. I was going to hear Bird play, you play Summertime, the strings be going.
Right.
You know. Then you play that one song. Wow, what was that song? Side TV show. Like this is exactly like you hear that. You know. Well, we don't want to expose our ages because we were around when the dawning of the age of television.
Right. That.
But I joined Horace with a friend of mine because we went to college together.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's documented in the book.
Right.
We went to school together, we were hanging out. And, and he told me he played with them. You know, which I was playing with another cat from New York whose name was James Brown. Played trombone. You never know?
Mm-hmm.
His name was J.E. Brown.
Mm-hmm.
He played trombone and drums.
Where's he now?
That's what I heard. He had went to Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
He was tight with Michael Keith.
Mm-hmm.
You know Michael
Keith?
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Passed away.
I know.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were tight. And anyway, we used to play together every day. That's why I used to play piano every day and everything. And so, one time, we went to Horace's rehearsal, and Sonny Chris was there, right? You know. I met Sonny Chris, but I thought I was Hogs Heaven. I met Sonny Chris and Horace Tapscott together, you know. And, I never was hearing these great players talk and say the words they were saying. I remember playing Sonny Chris's blow and he said, God damn, Horace, it's just too much for me, you know. I said, wow. I never heard that. And I was like, wow, he had a pint of liquor in his pocket and everything. You know, I'm saying, boy, these dudes are stoned and everything, but he didn't play like it, you know.
Right.
You know, he just zoomed through it.
Mm-hmm.
But he was playing, you know, he's a bebopper. And he's playing this McCoy Tyner tune, mode for John Coltrane, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And the tune was like, that's why he was saying that.
Mm-hmm.
But my friend was there, so we talked and everything. I still didn't pay no attention to it.
Mm-hmm.
But I told my friend, that sometimes, I don't know if I have all this, you know, we all have powers. Some of us never realize it in life, you know, but I said it to him twice, and I said to him, I said, you know what? I'm going to be in that band. I don't know how. I don't know when. I'm not even going to try. I don't know, but I'll bet you eventually I'll be in that band. And I said it 3 times. And I was just sitting at home, and he called, and he says, stop here. We need a tenor player in Horace's band. Why don't you come join? I said, okay, but you know, man, I don't read no music. He said, "That's okay, we'll teach you."
So that's the way that happened.
Yeah. Because, you know, I used to play R&B and just, you know, I used to want to be a combination of Albert Farrell and Frank Wright in one, you know. Because I said, those are the guys I want to be like, you know. Now I don't want to be like nobody. But then, you know, that was cool. So I said, okay, so that's how I joined.
Uh-huh.
You know, I did that. Then I ran to a couple more of my idols, like Ray Draper and stuff like that. You know, you knew Ray, right?
Mm-mm. Never met Ray.
Yeah. Mm-mm. He taught me how to read right. Mm-hmm. He said, if you don't feel it, you can't read. He said, feel it first and read second. And I was in this college, man, and they said, read first and feel second. And I never understood that. Mm-hmm. You know, but that's how I was doing. That's the conflict started, too.
Right.
And then in classes, I used to write compositions two different ways. One for them and one for me.
Right.
It was
two different worlds, man.
Yeah, and the way we write our music, you know, whether we do it spontaneously or by pen or pencil,
right,
it's against every rule they say.
Yeah, you can come out quick.
Because in art, there is no rules.
Were you doing a lot of written compositions?
Yeah, now.
Now.
But before that, at that point, I was just learning how to play. Mm-hmm. You know, because I mean, there were several bands within the band, which the written part of bands we were hard, but when we had our own bands, most of you played spontaneous back then. Mm-hmm. You know.
So what year did you actually join Tapsco? I think it was like 72?
1977.
Seven.
Early June.
Right.
I remember very well.
Uh-huh.
I remember the first gig I played very well. Where I messed up every song.
Where was the first gig?
I was high as a kite, messed up every song. He said, "How do you feel?" I said, "Loose." I didn't know how loose I felt.
Maybe how you messed it up was a contribution, no?
And then they said, and then I said, "Well, what did y'all think?" He said, "Man, you were cool." Yeah. But I had a drill sergeant. He was something. He thought he was a drill sergeant. But he was cool. Jesse was cool. I always tell Jesse these days, he's on Cecil's good side. Jesse Sharp. That was, you know. Him and Jamil are very close. And Rafe, they were close.
Right.
Yeah. They were the Antioch boys.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of people sort of drifted out there during the time that Cecil was in residence.
Oh, yeah. Have
you
our
talking
friends.
About Antioch?
Yeah.
College.
Right.
Half of our friends did.
Did Glenn Spearman was West Coast?
Yeah, you know, he was originally from the East Coast.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you a few things about Glenn. There was a certain drummer who was one of the first people that he played with.
Mm-hmm.
Take a guess.
A drummer? Nothing comes to mind.
We gave him rank. The mage.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Anybody who wonders who the major is, that's what we call Tom Bruno, because he's like that, you know. He keeps all of us in line.
That's right.
You know, he keeps us all in line. When him and Daniel first started Test Junior Street, I see him going to play with Daniel. He said, "Come on. Come on, man." Time. He said, "You ready, man? We want you out here, man." He keep telling me, he said, "We want you out here."
Right.
He said, "I used to play with Tom, and I stopped playing because I took a trip to Philly.
Uh-huh.
You know, I was messing with the wrong people and everything. And these drug guys came, they beat me and my friend up, man, Kusenatime. They almost drowned Kusenatime."
Uh-huh. Almost drowned him?
Yeah.
Wow.
And they broke my jaw with a gun.
That's when I met him.
Oh, yeah? His jaw was all broken.
We'll tell you about this.
Yeah.
Go ahead, tell him.
No, because I was playing in Grand Central Station.
Uh-huh.
And Kusenatime came. And introduced Sabir, you know.
Right.
And you know, Sabir seemed like a pretty nice guy, but I felt bad because I didn't think that he would ever play again because the way his jaw was all wired up.
Right.
But I couldn't have been more wrong.
Yeah.
Thankfully.
But it was a revelation for me too, because you see, it's a shame that we were finally putting his name out there and he's gone.
Mm-hmm.
He's been gone since 1991.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
But he kept telling me, say, yeah, man, you got to meet Daniel Carter, man. You got to meet Daniel Carter. He's playing avant-garde in this subway. Him and Charles Gayle are the only ones. And I already met Charles.
Right. Yeah.
But it took me almost a year to meet Daniel. He said,
uh-huh.
You got to meet Daniel Carter. He said, yeah. He said, he's the only one who's playing the way we're supposed to be playing today. And, you know, it took a long time. That night we walked to the Grand Central Station and he goes, wait a minute. Uh-oh. I think it's him. I know it's him. I said, who? He said, you'll find out in a minute. I said, who? He said, you'll find out. And it's so funny because the same leg that you have today, you had that. With the field jacket and the hat. Except, you know, you was more black. You know.
Yeah, you got more gray now.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's something though, cause see, we didn't know that Cousentin was gonna leave us.
Yeah.
So it's like, I mean, Cousentin and Sabir like this.
Right.
So it's like, you know, it's almost like I don't know, some weird something where like, you know, he hooked us up.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know.
Anybody around our age from Chicago, you ask them about Cousentin, and they know, especially Rasul Sadiq, Ernest Dawkins, and Hamid. They all knew Cousentin very well.
Did I tell you how I first met Cousentin?
That's a good story.
Yeah, Cousentin, yeah. I was stranded in Paris during the coldest winter in 40 years in Europe. I forget, 85.
Why were you there?
Huh?
Why were you in Paris?
Wild goose chase.
When you over there was sunny?
No.
When it was sunny in town?
Went over there with no gig.
Oh.
And all the Parisian people I knew was more poor than me.
Right.
And the water was frozen, the toilets were frozen, and I only had a one-way ticket to Paris. And I got American Express money to come back
right.
to the States from this guy, Gilbert Plantinga, a guitar player,
uh-huh.
to record. Well, generally, even in the States, I didn't have no recordings.
Right.
Now I'm always stranded, miraculously got this to come back home
uh-huh.
to record with Gilbert. So when I got into the studio, to rehearse, and I'm coming in late on these rehearsals.
Right.
There's, all of a sudden, there's this like, some doors, you know, like in a saloon, like
a cowboy thing. Oh yeah, swinging
thing.
Doors, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and somebody like, pushes them real hard, they go like flap, flap, uh-huh. flap. In walk Cousentin.
Uh-huh.
Cause I guess Gilbert knew Cousentin. I said, who is this? So he comes up to me, and
I know the story.
Grab my horn. And, you know, I didn't know whether to, like, say, man, you just don't grab my horn like that or give in. It's at that moment of decision.
Right.
So I said, well, Gilbert let the guy in. So this is like a force of nature. You know what I'm saying? It's like I give him the horn. He blasts the horn, breaks a reed, grabs another reed out of my box. So this is, you know, it's the first time I've ever seen this cat.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
But you know, the way he blew the horn.
Yeah, it was something.
You know, right?
He could play the alto, flute, harmonica. Sang the space blues.
He could juggle and do magic tricks.
Yeah, he's a magic. He did magic with David Murray's octet.
Really?
Yeah.
What kind of magic?
I don't know who that is, but he did. Constantine introduced me not only to Daniel, but he also introduced me to all the cats that I know now. William Parker, Roy Campbell, Zane Massey, Cecil. See who else? I'm trying to think. Dennis Charles. I could just go down the line.
Right.
It's not easy to remember offhand everybody.
Right.
You know, somebody ought to put a web page up on Constantine.
No. God, there's just so many.
So like, he wasn't based in Chicago anymore, was it?
No, he was in New York.
Based in New York.
We remember he was in New York.
Right.
Radu. Mm-hmm. You know, well.
That's right, because Radu was on that gig.
Arn Davis.
Yeah.
Tony Smith, we were all homeless together. Remember him, right?
I forget. I know the name.
Frank Wright.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. What's that guy? He was just Jerome Cooper. Thurman Barker.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's Thurman. A lot, like I said, it's a lot of people.
Did he play with all those guys?
Yeah. Well, he was from Chicago, but he wasn't an AACM guy.
Right.
Well, from what he was telling me, they had three different people. You know, the AACM.
Right.
Then they had the Sunrise people.
Right.
But that's what he was. Then they had another group of people. You know, I guess that's where Hamid falls in.
Mm-hmm.
But they all play together in New Jersey.
But then Hamid was Fred Anderson and stuff. He was part of the AACM too.
Yeah, he just never joined.
Right.
Yeah. Because, well, somehow I took Constantine in the way that Fred took Hamid in.
Mm-hmm.
Constantine was 18 and 19 playing baritone with somewhere.
Uh-huh.
He takes a solo on this tune, The Lost Recording.
Uh-huh.
It's the bass clarinet solo that's credited to Elo.
Constantine.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I think it was confirmed not long ago, but it was actually Constantine. And now he don't take it.
On bass clarinet?
Yeah.
Daniel, were you from New York originally, or you ended up there?
Not hardly from New York.
No.
I was born in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, right outside a place called Wilkinsburg.
Right.
And my father was working for the Air Force. Not uniform, he was a civilian.
Uh-huh.
But he moved around just about as much as the military.
Right.
So I lived in St. Louis for a real short while, Dayton, Ohio, Englewood, New Jersey, and up in Massachusetts, Sudbury, Massachusetts,
right.
New York.
Mm-hmm.
New York's been the longest place I lived.
But were you in New York when you started playing, or did you start playing?
I started playing, you know, like my life depended more on it than before when I got into the Army.
Because
that's when you make a decision between the M16 and the saxophone. So that was a clear choice.
That's funny. That's when they opened me up too. You know, because you was in the Air Force, in the Army band.
Army band, right.
So I wasn't in the band.
Right.
But I was able to join an R&B band.
Yeah.
And what you call mainstream bebop band.
Mm-hmm. You might have had a better deal than what I did.
Even though I didn't know the slightest thing about bebop.
You was playing music that you might, you know what I mean? You might have felt that music more than I was feeling the music in the Army band.
You were playing March music.
Well, they had
ceremonial music.
They had transcriptions of you know, classical pieces,
uh-huh.
And they had their own so-called jazz pieces.
Uh-huh.
I bet you were. People thought you were different than did they?
What you mean?
You
oh, you mean
I
like
mean.
Being what you being in the
Army? Outsider.
Oh yeah, well.
Because usually with us. It doesn't really happen with her. Even when I was in those bands, they looked to me more like an outsider. You know, like,
well, I know,
we know he can play, but why is he playing it this way?
Right.
And for us, it's like, this is how we felt like doing it.
That's right.
You know?
I remember in the Army, actually, it was this Italian-American guy and an Irish-American guy who was the three of us, we was into similar music. We was into Cecil Taylor, Coltrane, Ornette Coleman, and so on and so forth.
Right.
And so none of the black guys that was in the Army were in the Army band were into that kind of music.
Right.
You know, they were into only the Temptations. And what was the guitar player that almost everybody dug? He was jazz guitar.
George Benson?
Not George Benson. More veteran.
Wes Montgomery?
Right.
Oh, yeah.
They be in the West.
Oh, yeah. Right. Oh, my God. Boy.
But they would be in.
I mean, Wes Montgomery was a great guitar player.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
you know, he was great, yeah. But you know, it's just that what they did to us, to Wes before he died, was criminal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and, you know, they really, that was.
Were they typecasting or something?
That was the beginning of the CTI, Creed Taylor, homogenization of the music. And so, you know, people will come and, you know, well, what they did, they simplified his music.
Right.
You know, and made it, they killed the creativity.
Yep.
Or what they would do is release these records, and when the creative part came out, it would fade out. You know, this is what most people, you know, when it started on, they were saying, well, we're going to make you accessible to the black community. So we're going to really homogenize you and really mess you up. While in the meantime, smoking all of them and the Temptations found jazz. So it was really funny.
Right.
You know, but they were like show people, so they were doing like Joe Williams type stuff.
Right.
You know, but they really didn't understand John Coltrane, which was also the jazz station's fault too.
Maybe people understood the stuff all too well and make sure that it didn't get out.
Well, that was the main thing. Because when you hear John Coltrane making a record, his last live recording at the Olatunji Center, and them people were going crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And we were told there was mostly black people in the audience.
That's what I'm saying. If they let that music out the way it was, they could have caught all the black community on fire with it.
Because people love that concert. Because
right.
Somebody, the man formerly known as Butch, Raphael.
Yeah.
He was there.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that's how I know what was happening. He was telling me that they loved what he was doing.
Right. Yeah.
But we played in Harlem, all them places.
Yeah.
And they loved it.
Uh-huh.
You know, for some to say, well, how come we don't get this music?
Right.
You know, I say, well, you go to your, that's what I told him. It was me and Cassantine on the ride there. I said, well, why don't y'all just go to this radio station or to the club and tell them people at them clubs that y'all want this kind of music, what y'all heard.
Uh-huh.
You know, because.
Yeah, but the power of marketing, man, is like,
right.
You know.
Right.
I mean, marketing is part of censorship.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, don't turn the people on to something that's going to make them revolutionary.
We get back to that Army story.
Mm-hmm.
The one you were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
In the Army band. But you know, it was strange because I was in there after you because, you know, we don't go through that. A little older or younger. It doesn't matter. We're all ageless here. So, but anyway, when I was in there, but I'll give you the time sequence, early 70s. Anyway, I went to Thailand, right? And in the store, they always called, they always had these names, PX, the PX, and all this kind of stuff.
Right.
You know, XXX. But anyway.
That was on base.
The
store on base, right?
Yeah. I went in the store. You know, they had a whole Impulse Records section.
Oh, yeah. Now, that's
and
crazy.
Nothing else in jazz.
That's true.
But I bought, you know, I had, not Ascension, but it was some other trained records. I bought Kuluse Mama in there, right?
Uh-huh.
I bought some Shepherd in there. You know, I had all the Pharaohs. For some reason, they they enjoyed it. Creator has a master plan. Which a lot of people didn't understand it at first. They thought it was difficult. It was just kind of having a funk album you can dance to. But later, when the funk album Oh My God came along, then they understood that record, you know? You know, they finally got into new grass. You know, new grass to me is like, there's no difference between Albert playing new grass and Junior Walker playing Shotgun. The same thing. Because I saw Junior Walker, if I closed my eyes, I would think I'd see an Albert. Because he would play way in the five, you know, stratosphere notes, you know.
Right.
You know, and, but anyway, they had the whole section. They had a lot of Archie, Man Brown.
That's true.
I brought Albert at Greenwich Village because I had never heard Albert. I heard all about him, all the talk about him, but never heard him. And the first record I bought was Albert Allen at Greenwich Village. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I thought the music naturally fit.
Right.
But it was a good time for that and a good time for the rock music to come in together because the way they play guitars, the way musicians play saxophones, was almost hand in hand, you know? Mm-hmm. When you say so?
Yeah, I think a lot more could have happened if there was,
like Sonny Murray said in an interview one time, he said, yeah, they're trying to stop all this rock and this avant-garde because it's the only new music happening. That's what he said in his interview in 1969.
Right. Well, Sonny had a lot of theories, still does, about censorship and how you know how people try to rein a lot of that stuff in.
I was just going to say that something else came in that we haven't talked about is the increase of volume that I noticed somewhere between 68 and 70. It was a new regime of amplifiers up to 10 or 11 if possible. And, you know, maybe at first people were thinking that, okay, this is like youthful rebellions, you know.
Right.
But somebody was telling me also that the U.S. Army was doing experiments with Marshall amps.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, they fight with these amplifiers, whether it's Waco or Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, it's not unusual at all. All around the whole planet, everybody's jacked up with volume.
Right.
It's almost like building walls between each other, thinking that they're expressing themselves more.
Uh-huh.
And speaking of theories, that's a theory I've had with a lot of guitar players that I play with that play that loud.
Uh-huh.
It's not such a popular theory so far.
So you think that it's done as...
I can't believe it's just only youthful. I think the youth by themselves would be a little more intelligent.
So you think volume is kind of weaponization?
Yeah, I think it's a means of dividing and conquering.
Right.
Because when you actually hear each other much better at a much lower volume.
I mean, is that why Test always played without mics?
Well, I mean, Test, a lot of bands I play with in New York, we don't use PA.
Right.
You know, right. I mean, not everybody agreed with that.
I mean, but Test seemed sort of dedicated to that.
Concept. Well, I mean, every chance we had not to have to play with, I think, how many times did we play with PA? Just a very few times, right? I can't even remember.
When it comes to stuff like that, I have very short-term memory.
I don't think we did. And to me, it's not, as far as I'm concerned, I'm not anti-technology. I mean, to me, it's fascinating as long as you ain't going... You know, I mean, even maybe a gun could be fascinating, but you don't want to aim it at yourself.
Or anybody.
Or anybody.
Well, you already made your choice, saxophone over M16.
Or even any animal, so maybe they don't even need to be.
You might not even want to have to walk, since I saw the wall talking on TV not long ago.
All right.
Well, you know, everything, they say everything has life. Even the tables, you know.
That's right.
To the plastic on the bottom.
No, that's for real.
To the chair everybody sits on.
That's for real.
To these lights here, you know.
That's for real.
You know. I mean, we don't want to do anything to anybody. We don't even want to kill anybody. Even though most of us kill rats, roaches, and ants. We don't want to do nothing. But, you know. You know, you have some things in the instruments of the Creator for those who believe it, and you have some of those things who are instruments of the devil for those who don't believe it or believe it.
Right.
You know? Or positive and negative.
Well, what do you classify as instruments of the devil?
Well, I don't know. That depends on what you want to classify it as. To me, rats and roaches are. I mean, they come and threaten the things that I like. And number one is food.
Right.
You know, they'll come and they'll chew up my reed. You know, they'll come and hide in my case when I'm over somebody else's place. And I might not have none.
But we came
They've
to build.
Never happened to
we
me.
Came.
Oh, you're just waiting for it?
I don't wait for nothing. But I tell you one thing they all got in common. Too bad the girls left where they could hear. I tell you one thing they all have something in common. They all like music.
You think rats, roaches?
Well, they don't come around you when you play. You take a vicious dog. Now, my super at my place, he would, you know, he finally learned how to put his dog away from me. So I was getting ready to call the city on it, but he's a nice guy, so I didn't want to. But that dog would bark always the time I come in over. Me and my wife would start talking to him. But when we start rehearsing, you know, or I practice or something, it's quiet. You know, because, you know, that's the strength of music. You know, that's what music will do.
Right.
I've always been a firm believer, and I don't think I needed to hear music because the healing force of the universe to tell me that. I always believed that music would do that. I believe that if it wasn't for music, the only thing to be living on this planet is the planet. I believe people would be gone if it wasn't for music. You know? That's what I believe. You know, even the devil digs music.
Well, I'm wondering why, you know, we were talking yesterday and you said, why is the test has never made it to Europe?
Y'all hear that? You hear that?
I mean, test has never really been out of North America.
We sure haven't. We've been to Canada, though.
Right.
Yeah, three times. But it's very interesting. Well, it's not that we have been offered, I'll say that.
Right.
You know. But then it's like, maybe it's not the right moment. You know. And the moment, I feel the moment is upon us. You know? And to explain why Tess hasn't been to Europe is almost explaining why do we wake up at this time and not at that time? Or why did we go to bed at this time and not that time? Or why did we choose to wear the clothes we're wearing today and not wear something different? We can give 1,000 theories and explanations.
You guys have a lot more individual projects going on now, though, than you did in the early days of the band.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just wondering if it's scheduling, you know, scheduling stuff. It doesn't seem like Test is playing the way that,
well,
as much as you did.
No, but it exists. We have to remember that we were playing in the subway. We really didn't have that many gigs to begin with outside of the subway. We never did.
Right.
But we were playing in the subway, so
right.
It was like we were playing like almost every day.
You guys toured a lot, though, a few years ago.
Yeah.
Well, we went on two tours down south.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, one down south, one in the Midwest.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Actually, it was really weird. We started on the East Coast and ended up in the Midwest.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And back east.
Right.
That was a pretty long tour. Mm-hmm.
What's so weird about that? You went from the East Coast to the Midwest back to the East Coast? I thought you were going to say you ended up in like, Ehlers dropped you off in Chicago and
actually,
split.
Actually, I did the same thing with Rob Fainas a couple of years ago, so I can't say that. I did do that with Rob Fainas,
right.
And he was sick in the day.
Yeah.
I told you that this morning.
Right.
Yeah. But we started somewhere, I don't even remember where we started.
Right.
You know, but we did basically the same thing.
Uh-huh. But I mean, you've done those. I mean, that seemed like there were a lot of gigs on those tours.
Oh, like, yeah, it was number, a lot.
But, you know.
But we had a whole day where we drove.
Those tours are over in not more than a week. Not too much more than
a
week.
Oh, really?
Not anymore. But the that test was 2 weeks. That test was 2 weeks.
Yeah, 2 weeks.
Right.
Yeah,
that's the one.
That's out of like a whole bunch of years. How long the test exists?
Is that the one where I just got back from Japan? We went right away on tour? I got back in Japan the next day we were up to a test.
Right.
But I can't remember which one that was, the first one.
You know, sometimes the wind blows different ways. You know,
there you go.
I mean, like, the energy behind doing those tours, there was that energy. The people who backed those tours or organized those tours, that was there.
Uh-huh.
The recordings that were done, that was there. And it was all sort of bunched up in that little period of time.
Right.
And after that, it was different.
Mm-hmm. One thing not working a lot with Test, but it does is when we do play in New York, it might not, well, it does, except for the Valente Center, but what it does, it does bring people out.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, people will come out because you know, they say, oh, we haven't been around performing much.
Mm-hmm.
But because we played in the subway, it was almost like we were gigging every day.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, where we might look at it as a paid rehearsal.
Uh-huh.
You know, or not even that, you know. Mm-hmm. I guess it was a gig to us, you know. Mm-hmm. We get in there when we hit, you know, since, you know, most of us don't really play the subway that much anymore, it seems like we don't hardly work.
Does Tom still play subway, or?
Occasionally.
Uh-huh.
He has another group, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Uh-huh. With this guitar player, and Anders Nielsen, from Sweden.
Right.
And they play duets a lot. And so they go down there.
Yeah. I know you guys get over to Europe though with other groups. Does Tom get over to Europe much? Or?
He went to Scotland last year.
Right. That was for a solo thing, right?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Well, I don't think he comes to Europe.
Yeah.
Man, he goes out a lot with No Name.
Right.
We both go out with Steve Swell.
Right.
And then we get to play together a lot in different configurations, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like we'll go to Rome with Drew Durant,
right?
Or like what we're doing tonight,
mm-hmm.
or we play with Ben Duke, so so we get at least until the next edition comes out.
But it would be good to have Test over here, cause.
Yeah.
That's really the initiation of us playing together.
Right.
That's it almost happened last year.
Didn't you say it was advertised as somewhere, as Test, but it wasn't quite?
I'm talking about that. Yeah. You know, that was in Warsaw.
So who was that with?
That's me, Daniel, Hamid, and William.
Oh, okay.
You know.
Right.
But the thing was, they had it advertised as a test even in the book.
Yeah, I remember. I think I actually noticed that somewhere.
Yeah, somebody pulled a slick-a-rooney there.
Oh, it was a big one. Uh-huh. Yeah, we told the promoter when we got there. We even did a gig. We told him that this is not a test.
Because somebody was emailing me like left and right, talking about test, 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 test. We said yes, 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 yes. Then we didn't hear from them no more.
Right.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Even the promoter I'm going to work with tomorrow, which will remain nameless.
Uh-huh.
But he's a good promoter.
Uh-huh.
But now every time he's supposed to get tests of gigs,
uh-huh.
He did, but the money we wanted came up short. So. And I said, yes, I still want to work with Tesla, man. Every time I see him, because promoters this time, they can't get something for you. They act like a broken record.
Right.
Yeah. You know, a lot of these outside music business people, they talk like a broken record, or they run what you call the slickest game in town.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because they're trying to get you on their thing, you know.
Right.
And, you know, so you try to run the slickest game they can get going.
Nah.
And it's just like anything else, you know. Go for it or you don't. But I'm learning in music something I've learned from an old American saying. Good things come to those who wait. And,
well,
yeah. My mother told me wait broke the wagon down, but I never liked wagons, so it can keep breaking the wagon down, you know, because like I said, I find out that it's doing good. But recently I've been blessed with a promoter who's been interested in my music with my own band,
uh-huh.
You know, so I like to say my own band or I'm the leader.
Right.
Because in order to have a good band, you can't have any followers, you know.
What does that mean exactly?
Well, it means that you want people who can hold their own. Just like, you know, it's like in boxing, you know,
So you mean followers inside the band? Right.
You know.
I thought you meant fans.
No. I meant the followers, the musicians.
Right.
You know. Because you need media guys to hold up, help people up so they that we got many self-appointed leaders.
Right.
You know, because the industry made them leaders.
Uh-huh.
You know. And you know when you're a leader, because you don't just lead in music, you lead in your life. And since music is life, life is music, you know, you already know that if you have power to gravitate people towards you, you're a leader. You know, and that's, you know, where it is. You know, I mean, some people playing your band, they might not be leaders, but they're not followers.
Right.
You know, they're not, you know, when you hold your own, you're not a follower.
No.
You know.
And collaborators.
There you go. I like to say, for me, I like to say each band I have is a collective,
mm-hmm.
But my name is up front, as a front. You know, because, you know, everybody has a group. I don't care what it is, what they play, whatever they say. Everybody has a group to get a gig to make some money. And you're going to try to do anything you can to get over with that.
Right.
You know, so you're going to use whatever you use.
True.
You know, and all I say is this music, any music, takes a lot of patience. You know, don't be like the Flash or Quicksilver and try to. The comic book heroes and try to rush and do everything, because many things you rush to try to do is going to happen anyway. I mean, a lot of these people who quote unquote sold out don't realize they were getting ready to make money anyway.
You know, I think that's a beautiful spot to end. But, you know, if people got any, you want to see if anybody's got any questions from out there?
Ask me questions, ask Dan your questions.
Any questions? We'll
tell you no lies.
The question is, you've not mentioned all the years that you play every day on the Christmas. And then when we pass that, we just got the Sunday moon around over here, nobody gives it to us, nobody notices. And were you mainly playing for yourself playing, or were the regulars who knew how you were playing would come to listen?
Well, a train runs by every certain amount of minutes. So people are getting off all the time.
Getting on and off.
Right. Back and forth. So you're always playing to somebody.
No.
I mean, I played out in the subway 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning where a certain thing that you said might happen. Sometimes I would stop playing. But a lot of times I keep playing to keep me from falling asleep. during a normal day, in New York at least till 2 o'clock in the morning, you're going to have people flowing back and forth all the time. So it's never, like he was saying, I forgot what he just said, but anyway, it's like, there's always someone to play for down there.
And, I mean, it's all those people in New York walking around like in any big city. You're going to be playing for people whether they just walk past you or not. We definitely, we come out to play. We definitely put out the box for the money, if there's going to be any money. And it's also for ourselves too, because as far as I was concerned, I played enough years, actually decades, before I ever had the opportunity, the pleasure to play with a band. I was playing by myself. So when we got a band together, a lot of that playing outside or playing in the subway is to get our band together.
Right.
To keep our band, to develop and deepen that. So it served that as well. And, yeah.
So you never had to pay for a rehearsal space either.
Right. I mean, it was much. I mean, in that sense, it was much better than a rehearsal space. And in a way, it was better. A certain way, it was better than a lot of gigs because we generally went out there for a 3 and a half hour slot. So we play, take a break, come back and play. Because usually, play a gig, they got it cut down to like 40 minutes now. I mean, in the 70s. I did gigs that were sometimes 4 and 5 hours long.
You guys really only warm up after about 40 minutes.
What's that?
Likewise. It takes you guys 40 minutes to really warm up.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen you guys play some
for me anyway.
Long
gig
without a break.
Mm-hmm. But to play short is hard for me.
Right.
To play long is easier.
Well, yeah, because you have time to pace yourself. And without even thinking about it. Now, pacing yourself doesn't mean you always have to play slow. Mm-hmm. But you have time to project your thoughts. Thoughts is not the same kind of thoughts that you think. It's not thinking about what you're doing. Because the best music is played without thought. You're doing a spontaneous sequence. Here, there, just so that level you play.
And you get more loose.
Right. We come from the era.
You have
though.
To be as uptight.
Yeah. We come from the era, like he said, where you would play 4 or 5 hours with a small band. And this has been going on actually, not since Sunrise, which is that too, but And Cecil Petray did it also.
How long were Sunrise concerts?
Some of them had 5 hours, yeah. 4 or 5 hours.
Right. Right.
Yeah. It was amazing because I remember when I came back still in the 80s, I saw Sunrise do an hour and a half concert. I was really like, what?
You know? Yeah.
I said, it's over early.
I mean, how long were the, you know, like the shows? And Jamil had that big band in the early 70s, right?
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, Jamil? But I've never heard any, really, you know, much of that.
Who's Jamil?
Yeah, the documentation of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Were those long sets or were those?
I would
say they're pretty long.
I can't remember what they were.
Right.
Yeah. I never played in the big band until last 3 years anyway.
Right. Anybody else?
One thing I wanted to, something.
Get it off your chest.
More like, what do you call it?
Break it out.
It's academic, but it's unorthodox.
Uh-huh.
Anybody heard of Louis Kelso? Anybody heard of, well, of course you heard of Shakespeare. That's y'all's cat. But like, there's another Shakespeare, there's a more current. Then there's, who's heard of Arbuck, Mr. Fuller?
That's his idol.
Oh, Bucky? Bucky Ball?
Yeah.
My idol is Frantz Fanon.
So, this is a claim. Everybody got their pencils and paper? You know? Because write down these names and Google them. And see if a lot of the major problems we end today, if these people don't have the solution for it.
I think they don't.
I think they're part of the problem.
I just said it's a claim. But check it out for yourself.
Yeah.
Louis Kelso, K-E-L-S-O, Arbuck, Mr. Fuller. Shakespeare related to economics, but okay, there's one site that will have all this stuff. It's Harold Champ.
I have another question for you. But I might be labeled a racist if I ask this.
What's that?
What nationality are they all?
They all of the lighter hue.
That didn't answer my question. And I want to know why are it's only them.
I'm sure it ain't only them.
And I'm why sure haven't you researched other people?
You mean like the boy Fanon?
The great Fanon.
Right.
Who was the lead way to Malcolm X. Mm-hmm. Now he wasn't, they don't have all the answers either.
What, Wretched of the Earth?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they don't have all the answers either. No one has all the answers.
Well, Daniel, excluding Daniel.
No.
Oh.
And the greatest of all, I'm going to tell you who was one of the greatest of all, and that's Sun Ra.
Right.
You see, Sun Ra wasn't just a master of music or ancient Egyptian philosophy. He was the master of everything you just said. He would have some of the greatest talkers and thinkers in a room, and they would all leave confused and messed up. Because Sun Ra would talk about life in general. You know, I mean, this was a world, you know, and I mean, just talking to him distinctly. I've talked to Sun Ra where I couldn't tell the difference between his true voice and a cassette recording. Yeah. Happened the same night that I got my jaw broke in Philly. We went straight to Sun Ra's house. Hmm. The first thing he said was, I told you, no one never listens to me. I told everybody, Philadelphia is not a safe place. Nobody will listen to me. He said, I keep telling them, this is the city that will be the city of all cities But first, they got to get rid of all the evil in it. And I keep telling people that, and they don't believe. Then he turned around and did this whole philosophy thing. He was in his room for 3 hours, you know. And he was all excited anyway, because he was going to get the keys to Philadelphia the next day.
Right.
But he was talking, and no one even noticed that he went right from his voice to a cassette recording. And when the cassette was over, he was sitting there nodding. And then he came back in the conversation and says, oh, yes. And after that, and he went back into a whole different thing, you know. And he was always a joy in conversation, always a thrill. I mean, I had 2 or 3 hour conversations with Sun Ra on the telephone, you know. He said he would talk about all the different religions, you know. He would talk about love. Like, he made a song called God is Greater Than Love Will Ever Be.
Right.
Then he told me why he stopped playing that song. you know, but
why?
He said because he found out that love was something different. And he said it didn't relate to what he was talking about anymore.
No.
So he wouldn't do it again. You know. But he, you know, he said, he told John Coltrane, he said, you're going to die because you're playing too many notes and you won't take a break. You know. In fact, he said that so much that even that, well, that's one of the few things I have questions on, but you know. But he has even John Gilmore Marshall saying that. Because he believes, and there are such a thing where there are notes that are not in coherence with the universe. You know. Now to go into explanation for a long time with that would be a whole different story altogether. We would be here until we would miss our flights if we got into that room. Because we'd be in disagreement. And see, sometimes I find out the best friends you have are ones who constantly disagree with each other. Because it's fun and interesting for people. You're supposed to have your own philosophy, and that's why I did that, just to let you know that life is good when you have different philosophies. If you want to call it philosophy. It's better to have no philosophy, actually. But, you know, it's good to have different outlooks on things, because if everybody were the same, just think how boring it would be.
Very true.
You know. It would be terribly boring if we agreed on everything. You know, if I agreed with everything he agreed on, we probably wouldn't even play together. I mean, when you hear the note and hear the difference between the saxophone playing, you'll know.
Different philosophies of work.
Do you know we actually never had a rehearsal together? That's right. Why? We don't need to. And see, like I said, we're three different people up here. So we all have different ways of how we think life should be. Not for you, but for me and us. And it's the same thing with music, which is life. Life is music. You know, music is sound. Music is that sound, whatever that is coming from. Ventilation sound.
Right.
You know, music is that. Music is this. Music is your spouse. Music is everything.
It's a good spot to end.
Yeah.
All right, man. Sabir Mateen, Daniel Carter. Thank you. very much. Good.
Thank you, Byron. All right, Coley. Daniel Carter.
Hey, Ben. Thanks, man. It's good.
And you. Please come see us at 10:30. If you're not exhausted. And if you are, we'll make you feel relaxed.
Have a cot.